I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Good evening, Vashon Island. I am Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies on Voice of Vashon 101.9. This is a travel show, and I like to have people on that have been all over the world. And today, we have a really awesome person named Rick Reed, longtime Vashon person, retired trial lawyer. Rick, how long have you been on Vashon?
Since 2006.
Where were you before?
Lake Forest Park for about another 16 years.
Nice.
So I have spent most of my life in King County, either east side, north end, or now on Vashon.
And in addition to being a longtime King County resident, which is, can go either way, good or bad, depending on how you view King County, you have literally traveled all over the world. And you were telling me earlier about how you got started. In 1967, you were a ninth grader, and your parents pulled you out of school to take a trip to Asia for a month.
That's right. My parents got the travel bug in 1962 and took a 6 weeks in Europe, and they came back, and they were all jazzed about seeing the world. So much to our surprise, in 1967, in April, my sister Faith and I were dragged along for a month-long tour of Asia, and we went to Japan and Hong Kong and Macau, which was a much different place then. It was really very primitive place then. And then to Bangkok, and then to Kuala Lumpur and Singapore and Manila, and then back to the same old stuff in Bellevue. But
and you have since, I mean, we're going to backtrack a little bit, but since then, you have gone back to these places.
Yes.
What is the difference? What are some of the most significant differences that you've seen since 1967 to, say, what was the year they took it 19 years ago, about 19 years?
Well, I was, for example, recently I was in Singapore just 2 years ago, and I tried to find anything that was the same as it was in 1967, and the only thing I could see was the Raffles Hotel. Everything else was 100% different, with the sky rises, sky-high buildings and casinos and everything like that. It was just kind of a slow post thing. And same with Macau. I mean, it's just completely, entirely different. There are some traditional villages that stay the same. There are some traditional places in, you know, historic cities that stay the same, but
The cities really change.
The cities really change.
Yeah, I mean, that's cities in general, but I've heard from other people that the Asian cities really, I mean, they build so fast and furious, and it just, they go higher and higher and so modern.
It was surprising to be taken out of school for a month. My parents were always very strict about going to school. And when they finally said, we're going to take you out of school for a month, I just couldn't believe it.
You must have been, it was like Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Times a million.
And I was telling you, I was a very young looking guy. I was ninth grader, but I probably looked like about a seventh grader. And I have stories that are helped preserved by my mom's travel journal from that trip. She always kept a travel journal too, including a hotel fire where I went up through the burned-out wreckage without any supervision, swinging on ropes out of caves and things that, you know, no one really gave me permission to do. And because I was just a boy on kind of loose in the world.
You're a wild child.
We'll tell some stories about that later.
So then you grew up into, you know, young adults and started taking your own trips. And Europe was the first place that you went, correct?
Yeah, I bought a Eurail pass.
And what year is this?
This is 1971.
Mm-hmm.
I was 19 years old. It was the summer after my freshman year in college at the University of Washington. And I told my folks that I was going with my friend Quentin because they didn't want me to go alone. But we had decided we didn't have the same goals, so we stayed together for about a week and then split up. But I was in Europe with my Eurail pass and a backpack. until the fall, going any place I wanted to go without anyone telling me what to do. And I took a bunch of chances. And,
that's liberating as a young person.
Yes, yes. And again, in 1971, I had, I was still quite young, but my passport was from the earlier trip in 1967. That was before I went through puberty. So I was 5'1 in the passport, the old passport. And the second thing about it is that passport I was traveling on in 71 said on its face that it had expired. It had been renewed by congressional action. So it was valid in international law, but it wasn't valid on its face. So I had this passport.
Oh, how odd.
It showed that I had not extended it, not renewed it.
I would like to take note that he brought these passports with him.
Yeah, I still have them. And again, I've got travel journals. I've got memorabilia from lots of my travels,
too. Yeah, that he has here that he's going to share with us as the show goes on.
In any event, I went from as far north as Norway, as far south as Dubrovnik, and had a lot of great experiences running around Europe with either a rail pass or a
thumb. Tell us one of your greatest stories from that trip.
Well, I went to Amsterdam. I landed in London, went to Amsterdam. Of course, this was a time when drugs in Amsterdam were sort of hand in hand. There was technically then laws against smoking marijuana and hashish, but it was not being honored in any way significantly. I stayed in the red light district in a hotel right in, a hostel right in the red light district.
Mm-hmm.
And I met up with New York kids from Joe Colombo, the gangster's neighborhood. And we had kind of became running buddies in the bad part of Amsterdam. And I went along on a drug buy just to see what it was like. The guy said, I don't want to go make this big hashish purchase without somebody with me. Would you go with me? And so I did. Think about naive. I tell that story as sort of, that's where I started with this summer.
How much hashish are we talking about?
2 kilos.
That's a fair amount.
That would get you in jail for a while, even in Amsterdam.
Wow.
And so another story is I had a friend from back here in the States who was going to be studying in Venice. And I just knew the month she was going to study there and that she was going to be in Venice. Pretty girl, got to give it a shot. I got to Venice. I'd been on the road for a couple months. I walked down there looking for a place to stay, and there she is. She yells my name, and we give a big hug in the streets of Venice.
Isn't that amazing how you could have found each other?
Yeah. I didn't have an address. I didn't have a contact number or even the name of her school or she was studying. I just knew she was going to be in Venice that month. We bumped into each other within about, I don't know, an hour after me arriving in Venice.
That's amazing. Truly. So many things have to take place for that kind of serendipity in the right direction.
So I managed to read a lot. I was really a bookworm in those days. So if I was hitchhiking, you read at the side of the road with your hand up like this. It's not the most effective way to hitchhike, or waiting for a train or something like that. So when I crossed into Yugoslavia, which is still the name of the country in that days, and was still with General Franco. Tito, General Tito. I did go through Franco, Spain, too. But the people asked to see what was in my backpack. And I said, it's just books and dirty clothes. And they looked at the books and they took a couple of them out. They didn't want me to carry into the country and let me go in.
What would be the books that they would take out?
There were Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and things like that.
Yeah.
I was reading everything I could get my hands on. You trade books at, with other fellow travelers, you don't get much selection. I'll take a science fiction book and for a history book, whatever you got, So, and I tell that story about going into the communist country because again, I didn't have proper documentation. So they were satisfied with my apparently expired passport.
And you didn't have to get a visa to go
in?
No.
I went by freighter down the coast, overnight, sleeping on the deck, freighter, where...
Dubrovnik.
Well, we stopped in Split and Hvar and Dubrovnik finally, so...
I wish I could have seen that then in 1971.
In fact, there's another example of
a place... Do you have pictures from it?
That first trip, my camera broke within the first month. I have letters home. I have letters to my girlfriend. And I kept those all these years and helped.
Did the Venetian, the girl from Venice, become your girlfriend?
No, she was a girlfriend of...
Rick's got all the ladies. Who knew?
A friend of mine. She was my friend Gordy's girlfriend.
Oh.
She was friendly with my girlfriend, so...
Got it.
She's still a friend. She lives over in Sun Valley.
And then where did you go after that?
Well, my mom had wanted me to go to Dubrovnik because she had made friends with Maria Sarachetti, who had a bed and breakfast in Dubrovnik. And when she was there, the towels were available in communist Yugoslavia, were very drab towels and very poor sheets. So my mom had sent her some high-quality linens and bed linens for her bed and breakfast. And so when I arrived there in Dubrovnik, I was treated like a prince. I mean, I'd been living in hostels or under a park bench or something, and all of a sudden I've got the best room in the bed and breakfast. And she took me to a play in Serbo-Croatian. I saw Hamlet in Serbo-Croatian, and I ate mussels on the beach for the first time. This was just a marvelous experience for me. But time was running out, and I'd promised my mom two things, to go see Maria Sarachetti and to go see my relatives in Norway. And it's a long distance between...
Yeah, that's pretty far.
So I was hustling, and I'd got to Oslo, I called them up. They didn't pick up. I said, I want to go to Berlin. And I didn't see my relatives in Norway. I said, I got to the town, I called them, they didn't answer, that was it.
You didn't try and go to the house?
Nope.
You just weren't that interested?
I just wanted to go to Berlin more because I wanted to be in Berlin.
It's a pretty cool city. I understand why.
So I backtracked from Oslo to Copenhagen. And there was a train service between Copenhagen and Berlin. And the Eurail Pass doesn't work on that section. So I bought a train ticket. And I have the brochure from the train. And it I didn't notice it at the time. But it shows clearly that the route the train travels between Copenhagen and Berlin goes through East Germany. This is at the height of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
1971, that's just 10 years after the Berlin Wall went up. And the parties had not agreed as to the status of Berlin. So everything was on very, very high alert. And because the Berlin Wall was up, crossing the border was nearly impossible.
And there you were traveling, a young American by yourself.
Right.
Very suspicious.
When I got to the port, when the ferry... dropped the train off on the port. It didn't clear customs. We just continued on. We rolled through the East German countryside for about 3 hours. And I'm getting nervous because I had expected to have a problem here and I wasn't sure what problem I was going to have, but I knew that going into East Germany was not what I expected. I thought I was going to West Berlin back through Germany, through West Germany. So I get to the East train station, East Bahnhof, and it's after dark. It's late at night, and I'm clearly in East Berlin, and I told you, Megan, that this story gives me goosebumps every time I tell it, because it's scary times your body remembers.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
So I don't have any East marks, which is a different currency that they use then, and you're required to make a certain amount of currency exchange. I didn't have a passport valid on its face, and I didn't have a clear idea how to get to West Berlin. So I went into a souvenir shop in the train station, which was open. And this woman spoke a little bit of English, and she understood me to ask, how do I get to West Berlin? And she had a wall map in her souvenir shop.
Mm-hmm.
And she pointed where I had to go. And I memorized the route through East Berlin. And I bought a little pin, enameled pin, to thank her for the...
Which he has with him.
Yeah, 50 years ago.
So it's this little pin.
It says Berlin. It says Berlin, Hauptstadt der DDR, which is capital city of the German Democratic Republic. And
it's a cool little pin.
So I walked over to Friedrichstrasse in the dark, trying to not be noticed. And there is a train station. It actually is an intersection of subway trains and surface trains. And it's the only crossing that's open at night. from, at that time anyway, from East Berlin to West Berlin. And I walk into a well-lit hallway after being in the dark. It was very intimidating. And I see where the border is. And there are East German police, Stasi, state police, and Russians, I think. And they're not paying attention to me. And I look across and I can see the German police, the Berlin police, and some American GIs. And it's walking distance. And it's bright. But no one's stopping me. So I just walk. I take about 30 steps across that open plaza.
Wow.
And the guys on the other side say, "You could have been shot." And I said, "I guess I could have," because I knew that people were being shot for crossing. So anyway.
Can I ask you, what if you knew that you could have been shot, why did you do it?
Because I thought I might be detained because I didn't have proper papers.
Got it.
And I told that I had done sort of shady things, sketchy things earlier in the summer. This is toward the end of my trip. I mean, I did things like climb up to the top of the 90-meter ski hill in Kitzbühel without permission. I went over the barbed wire.
Or Where's Kitzbühel?
Austria. You know, I said there's this old international Olympics ski jump hill, 90-meter hill. I went over there. I walked over there and climbed the thing. And you know, I was not supposed to stay out of there. I'd slept in parks. I'd crashed in places like youth hostels I didn't pay for. I mean, I was kind of
going through the
19-year-old. They can't stop me.
Yeah.
I just decided to walk through.
Well,
now
you have
the story continues. Next day, I decided to go back to East Berlin to test whether my papers were good, and they stopped me. They said, "You don't have a valid passport." So it confirmed that my papers would not been any good for the state police. And then when I was turned back, the American GIs who stationed at Checkpoint Charlie knew that I'd crossed illegally the night before. And they arranged an army car with a driver to take me to the consulate in Berlin. It waited for me while I got my passport renewed and then drove me back to Checkpoint Charlie, just courtesy of the U.S. Army. And so, anyway, 19-year-old, long-haired backpacker getting army treatment like I was a celebrity or something.
Rick, that's an amazing story. You truly have some cojones, let's just say that, to pull that off, because I don't think most people would ever even attempt that, something like that.
And I told Megan, I think it's my best travel story. I've got lots of them, but I don't think anyone can top crossing during the middle of the Cold War.
No.
In the period from 1961 to 1989, 140 people were shot.
You're very lucky to be here telling that story. Were they mostly East Berlin people or East Germans that were shot?
Yeah. It was the exodus from the east to the west.
Yeah.
There were some other people who were, you know, died with car crashes, trying to crash through the fence and stuff. But I think those 140 people were actually shot. Some of them were left dying. No one would go into the death zone out. So, but
I wonder how many people crossed illegally and made it through.
In the early days, before they put in the Berlin Wall, it was hundreds of thousands.
Yeah,
that's why they put the wall up. But
Rick, thank you for sharing that story with us. It's remarkable. Rick, you're going to take us to some more contemporary times. About 19 years ago, you and your wife, Molly, and your two children took a trip, a worldwide trip that lasted 10 months? How long was it supposed to last?
It was scheduled for 10 months. We missed about a month because I got sick in Madrid and had to come home for a while.
Will you tell me how that transpired and where all you guys went to? And not every, you don't have to name every single place. I don't mean that, but you know.
Well, as I said, my parents were travelers and yeah. I got the travel bug. And we sort of tried to pass it on to our girls, Alexandra and Rebecca. And when my mom died, and she'd always lived a very frugal life, child of the Depression, couldn't spend money for anything except travel. She could stay in the Daniele in Venice, but she couldn't buy herself a new purse at home. That kind of mentality.
Yeah.
So when she left us an unexpected legacy, I suggested to Molly that we go take the girls for a month in the south of France. And Molly said, as she will for lots of my life, think bigger. And so we
sat down. That's a good person to have by your side.
So we sat down. Girls were 14 and 15 in high school, junior high and high school. We sat down at the dining room table with a yellow legal pad and said to them, we're going to pass this pad around and you get to write a place you'd like to go on the earth. Anything you want. And so somebody would say, I want to see the Galapagos Islands. And then they pass it on. I want to see the Great Wall of China. And they pass it on. And I'd say, I want to, you know, go to the south of France. I want to go on a safari. I want to go to the Great Barrier Reef. And we passed around a few times and said, well, that's probably about enough. And we tried to do them all.
How many stops did you guys have on this trip?
Well, stops is kind of hard to remember. I do have my travel journal. So I could probably figure that out. And my travel journal is 600 pages long with lots of mementos and curios and train tickets and postcards to kind of illustrate it.
Do you think you'll ever turn it into a book?
No, I wrote it just for memory.
Yeah, just for you.
Yeah, it helps me remember things. If you're on a whirlwind tour of Europe for... I wrote letters to help remember, but ever since then, I've done like my mom did and keep a travel journal.
That's smart, yeah.
It takes discipline to do it for 10 months, though, I'll tell you that much.
Well, you've got 3 full books.
Yeah, I do.
So you're clearly disciplined.
So we did fly to Southeast Asia.
Was that the first leg of your
that
trip?
That was the first leg. Molly had broken her wrist right before we were to leave, badly. She's, you know, comminuted fracture of the distal radius. I remember hearing that thing. I had to have surgery on it to put it back together. We couldn't take off on the first flight. We immediately used our travel insurance. This travel insurance was supposed to be there for the whole year. We spent it the first 2 weeks before we left. We got to Bangkok. Instead of recovering in a hotel room, she recovered in a 5-star hotel.
That seems reasonable.
She got sick in Southeast Asia, and we almost aborted the trip. Some sort of fever or tropical disease. And she was circling the drain. And I called my dad in Maui. I said, can we retreat to Maui? We were just in Bangkok. We'd been in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia first. And then he said, yeah, but I couldn't figure out how to get there with her being so sick. So I found a place called Koh Samui, which is an island like Maui on the Gulf of Thailand. And she recovered there from that.
Was there a hospital there?
No, she... recovered with help of pineapple juice and a warm breeze. And that's about it.
How long did it take?
About a week.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than being sick on a trip.
She was so sick, she couldn't keep anything down. Oh. And she was losing weight rapidly, and she was totally out of it a lot of the time. So our trip started with a breaking her wrist, and the first month she was sick. We almost bailed.
Yeah.
As a result... Sure. She doesn't remember Southeast Asia very well. She didn't leave the hotel room or go very far.
Do you read her excerpts from your
Yeah, she's been
journal.
Told stories. And the yeah. girls and I love Vietnam. I'd love to go back to Vietnam. And we were in Thailand not too long ago, Molly and I were. And I like Thailand too a lot. But she doesn't remember Thailand from our trip around the world.
After Asia, where did you guys go to?
Well, kind of a convoluted long-distance route. We went to China and Nepal, and then we backtracked all the way to the South Island in New Zealand. And then we went to China and Tibet, and then we backtracked to South Island in New Zealand after going through China again. And then we went up to India and then to Nepal. So the distance between Kathmandu And Lhasa, Tibet is about 800 miles, I think, if my memory serves. But to do that, we went all the way up as high as, you know, north of China and all the way to the South Island, New Zealand before we got back that way.
Wow.
And then we flew from India to Egypt, where we took a Nile cruise and saw all the antiquities and rode camels in the desert. And
how long were you in Egypt?
About a month.
Yeah.
We took vacations from our vacation. We couldn't keep the pace up. So periodically we'd slow down for a week or two. And so we had this Nile cruise for, I think, 10 days or something like that. And then we took a 2-week vacation on the Red Sea where the girls got scuba certified. And I did too. And then we started moving on again. And we flew from Cairo to Nairobi in Kenya,
mm-hmm.
where we went on safari for 2 weeks in Kenya and Tanzania. So that did our African piece. And then we flew back to Athens, which seemed like going to Bellevue because it was we'd been all these exotic places. Athens seems so normal. We just went shopping. You know, let's go buy underwear. Athens, oh, so it's old. I've seen older.
Will you tell us one crazy story from this 10 or 9 month trip that was one of your favorites? Favorite places or, you know, just an experience that really changed you?
I'll tell you that if you haven't been on safari, you really ought to do it.
No, I never have.
You go out to these parks, and some parks are beautiful, some parks are even more beautiful, but they're all remarkably homey in the sense that I felt like I'd been there before, even though I hadn't, that this is the true home of humans. That I have cellular memory of being in Africa. And some days you'd see lions, and some days you'd see elephants, and some days you see rhinos, and some days you see hippos, and some days you see all sorts of antelope and, you know, kudzu and all sorts of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But just being there really was satisfying to me. And so it was interesting, at the end of our trip, the four of us, Molly, Alexander, Rebecca, and I, said, what was your favorite thing? And we all said, Kenya.
Can imagine, it's quite beautiful.
The second runner-up for all favorite was the south of France, which I wanted to go to in the first place. I got a story about that, too.
Where did you guys end your trip at? What was the last country?
Well, we were supposed to go to the Amazon and then to Peru before flying home. And the Galapagos was going to be our end zone. But I got some sort of illness in Europe, in Spain and Portugal, raging night fevers. To the point where it was scary for Molly, who had been so sick earlier on the trip, to see me just drying out cold, wet towels with my fever. And then they go away during the day. So I knew we were going to the Amazon next. So I went to a doctor in Madrid. He was actually French-Canadian. And he says, well, you present kind of an interesting diagnostic puzzle for me on a Friday afternoon. You've been everywhere. You've been exposed to every kind of germ. You say you have these fevers. You're not feverish now. And you want me to give you permission to go to the Amazon, where there's very few doctors. I can't do that. I'm going to give you permission to go home and talk to your own doctor.
Sure, that makes sense.
And so I flew home and was well. The fever was never diagnosed. There was no symptoms. No tests showed any infection of all. I missed the Amazon and Machu Picchu. We all did.
But you know what? You can still go, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Rick, I'd like to have you on again sometime to go further into detail of that trip because it sounds like an amazing time.
It was.
At this moment, we've got to wrap it up here. But
I'm always available, Megan.
Good. I'm glad.
And,
thank you.
I have other travels I like to tell stories about, running the bulls of Pamplona is a good one.
Oh, that would be, okay. I will definitely have you on again.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
It's been enjoyable.
I've been everywhere.
Thank you so much, Vashon Island. This is Megan Hastings and the Cats and Jammer Follies. See you again in another place in the world.